Welcome to ASME TechCast, bringing you the innovations, the innovators, and the issues that push the envelope of engineering. I'm Jeffrey Winters, editor-in-chief at Mechanical Engineering Magazine. And today we get to talk with Pavan Mazumdar, chief operating officer at Automation Alley, a nonprofit industry 4.0 knowledge center based in Troy, Michigan. Mr. Mazumdar is also the CEO of the organization's Project Diamond 3D printing network, and he's here to discuss the present state and bright potential for Industry 4.0 to transform small and medium-sized manufacturers. Pavan, welcome to the big show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as most of you out in podcast land know, there's already a suite of digitally enabled technologies rushing onto the factory floor. It goes by a few different names: Industry 4.0, or Advanced Manufacturing, or the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Those are just a few of them. But these technologies combine embedded sensors, new kinds of materials, models as digital twins, and cutting-edge computing to change the way that companies think about their products and facilities, and even their customers. There's probably no technology more identified with Industry 4.0 than additive manufacturing, or 3D printing. It's a way of building parts and products that can not only cut down on waste, but also enable designs that aren't physically possible through any other method. And because the printers work off of computer models, additive is an inherently digital format. While that's very exciting in the abstract, it can be daunting if you are a small company that has had success with traditional manufacturing processes, what would be called, I guess, Industry 3.0. These are companies without big research divisions or development budgets and are keenly aware that on the return on every investment. So how do they become part of this new industrial revolution? That's what Pavan Mazumdar is here to talk about. So, strap in. Let's start with this. From where you sit at Automation Alley, what is the level of adoption of Industry 4.0 in these medium and small size manufacturers? I imagine 3D printing is probably the easiest to adopt. Is there uptake on others?
You know, Jeff, so your introduction to how you described what's happening in Industry 4.0 really captures the essence of what's going on. So you mentioned how these technologies can be daunting to the small and medium-sized businesses. And the reason they are is because of exactly what you said. They're used to doing things a certain way. And now there's this completely disruptive way of doing things. You mentioned digitization. And as you correctly put, Industry 4.0 is this collection of technologies. We look at it very simply as Industry 4.0 is that disruptive force that is forcing manufacturers to think like software companies. So fundamentally, they're changing. They need to change the way they're operating. They need to change the way they're doing business. And so to answer your question very directly, that uptake, that transformation is all over the board. You know, when we did Project Diamond, which we'll talk a little bit about it, the result that we saw was very much like a bell curve. We saw some companies, I'd say about 20%, 10 to 20%, that were leading the pack. These companies adopted 3D printing and were pretty much off to the races. Then we had this big bulge in the middle, very much like a bell curve, about 60% of the companies that were starting to play with it, but were sort of, you know, still figuring things out. And then we have about 10% of companies that really didn't even get it. They looked at the program differently than what its spirit and its intent was. And so we see this over and over again. And part of the reason is, and we'll get to some of this, it's culture, it's lack of familiarity, things like that. But then there's also a positive, which is once the inspiration becomes clear, the path to adoption, at least in small and medium-sized businesses, tends to be very quick because of their nimbleness. So it's being small is a double-edged sword. Sometimes there's lack of resources on the one hand, but that can often be made up in agility because of the democratization of technology. We'll get to some of that.
Right. Well, I mean, let's just pull on that for a second, because I think that's interesting. So on the one hand, you know, small can mean small-minded or like limited in resource or limited in scope. But what you're saying is that once people get it, and once they know that it's that this is the future and this is the future for them, they're small enough to actually turn very and pivot very quickly and move into this new direction. Where as a larger organization, they might have the resources to get started on it, but they might not actually be able to pivot as quickly. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. What we see in larger organizations is that the culture tends to be the inertial force.
Okay.
And the culture is a combination of social norms. It's a combination of processes. It's a combination of way of doing things. It's a combination of how executive decisions are pushed down into the middle tier and then to the lowest tier of the organization. All those factors tend to be headwind to change in the way of doing things.
Okay.
In a small business, very often the layers are much smaller in number. The executive function, if you will, plays a very strong operational function, and their decision-making can be very quickly. I'll give you an anecdote.
Okay.
One of the companies that we had in our Project Diamond program was given, so we'll get to a Project Diamond, but very simply what we did was, as part of the pandemic, we got this grant funding and we distributed 3D printers to small and medium-sized manufacturers in Oakland County. One of these companies is a very traditional manufacturer, and it's a company called Air and Liquid Systems, and they make these very large tanks, purification systems, very interesting company, very strong engineering capabilities, very traditional in its manufacturing. They got this 3D printer, and initially the owner himself were very skeptical, and he said, hey, let me, you know, everybody was trying to figure out, what am I going to do with this pandemic? Is just becoming such a disruption. It's just this complete kind of, you know, lack of complete uncertainty, right, in the business environment. And so he said, let's participate in this program. They got the printer, they started playing with it, and they came up with one component. It was actually, I believe it was like a valve or something like that, or some component that fit on one of their tanks. And they were traditionally making it for $100. It was stainless steel. And they said, let's see, because it wasn't, the stainless steel was just corrosion. That was the, right. They said, let's make it with 3D printed components, and let's see if it can pass the quality requirements of the product. And it did. And that cost difference from $100, which by the way had some supply chain implications as well, came down to like $2.
Wow.
And that was the only example. That was the only use case that this owner needed. And he just put out this mandate to his engineers and said, I want you to go through every single thing that we're buying, and I want to see if this can be reproduced internally. And this company just completely adopted additive because they saw a new path. And the owner essentially just pivoted the organization. That's the example of that executive decision making. Not only that, he also subsequently said, this new technology stuff is actually really interesting. And he invested in a laser welding machine, completely unrelated to additive, because he became a disciple. He became, you know, transformed. And that's an example where you need that one inspiration, and then you just have to get out of the way. Because, right. You know, our businesses are extremely innovative. It's just that they've been doing things the same way for years and years and years. You know, it's like if you've watched the movie The Titanic, you know, one of the comments is, you know, this captain had 20 years of experience working against him. Hmm. And so sometimes that becomes the impediment. But once they learn that, very, very quickly do they pivot. And that's that's the inspiration. That's the positive. That's the lining, silver lining that we're looking right. for.
Now, so Project Diamond, as you mentioned, was involved with getting 3D printers into the hands of manufacturers. Well, a little bit more background on that. Like, did it start? Did it start with the pandemic, or was something that was prior to that? And approximately, how many people? You know, how many companies got these printers?
Sure. So it was a very simple program, and it was simple only after having to iterate through constraints. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So if you recall the early days of the pandemic, we were really not prepared as a nation when it came to PPE, personal protective equipment. We were having all kinds of trouble sourcing that, and all local and regional governments were facing the same problem. I would say sometime in the April, May timeframe, we started having conversations about this. And really what the trigger was, if you remember, there was a CARES grant that the federal government made available to small and I would say local governments. And Oakland County, which is the home of Automation Alley, came to us and they said, we've got a, you know, about, and I'm making, these numbers aren't 100% accurate, but I'm giving you sort of like a general idea of the scale, about $200 million in federal funding. We'd like to allocate 95% on very tactical objectives and tactical allocation, but we'd like to allocate about 5% or $10 million on a transformative program. And we'd like something that has the same affect, if you will, of the Defensive Production Act. You know, back in the day, if you remember in the Second World War, the Willow Run plant was pivoted to produce B-24 bombers, you know, something like that, something that has that, but with the contextual realities of Industry 4.0. What does that look like? And we went through many iterations and they said, oh, by the way, you have to spend the money by December 31st, 2020. Well, that's a constraint. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, the traditional way of doing something like this, where we would spend some time analyzing, spend some time kind of, you know, doing some groundwork. Well, that we didn't have the luxury of that, right? So what we said was, it's a very simple premise. Our manufacturers are not going to invest in advanced technologies on their own. They don't necessarily have either resources, the incentive, the impetus to do it. Why don't we make a grant, devise a grant program where we give them a 3D printer, and we make that conditional upon a couple of things. One is we say, you use this 3D printer as if it were your own, do with it whatever you want. Make spare parts, make production parts, make prototype parts, whatever it is that you do in your business, that is an application with this 3D printer. The second thing we said was, if we call upon you, we would like you to make that 3D printer available to print PPE. And this would be the type of PPE that would be producible by that 3D printer. And that was a simple premise. And we said, you now also have to participate in a community of your peers. Now, generally, when you have an ecosystem of manufacturers, they're not necessarily competitive. It's, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration because the competition tends to be, you know, by, you know, either industry group or something like that. So it's very easy to create these communities. And often manufacturers like to create those peer communities. And that was the simple premise. And so we worked with our partners. We identified Mark Forged as our first partner to develop this. This came as a reference from one of our consultants that we were working with. And the reason we wanted to keep it very simple, we said, we're just going to single source this. This is an experiment as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. This is an option like bet. This grant program may turn out to be something amazing, or at the minimum, it just might be, hey, we're giving out, we're seeding the market with some 3D printers. We didn't know where it would go. So the numbers were 250 manufacturers in Oakland County was the target. And then our neighboring county, Macomb County, came on and they said, we like this program. We don't quite have the same resources. We'd like to come on for another 50. So we had 250 from Oakland, 50 from Macomb, for a total grant value of about $12 million. That was the simple premise. And when we did this program, we kind of knew at that time that we probably would not need to use these printers for PPE, because by the time we were starting to deploy the printers out in the field, the supply chains had already reconfigured and PPE was, again, quite readily available. You know, Masks were available, isolation gowns were available, the medical theories about ventilators and their use was changing. All of this stuff was becoming, completely, quite different from just 3 to 4 months before. But the premise of using 3D printing within the organization, that didn't change. So a lot of these companies started playing out with this, and this was, as I mentioned in the early part of our conversation, we noticed this bell curve in terms of adoption. We saw a few companies that were just leading the pack. We saw this middle company that were starting to kind of get their hands, and then we saw some companies that were just unable to figure out what to do. That learning was essentially what led to what we're now talking about in phase two, which we can talk a little bit about in terms of the intent. One of the validations that we did receive of Project Diamond was, as I said before, we were not necessarily thinking we would be using this for PPE. But when Russia invaded Ukraine in March of 2022, that's when we essentially had this opportunity to validate the network. And we got a request through one of our partners in the western part of the state that the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense was requesting tourniquets and tourniquet clips. And it so happened that the production of those tourniquet clips required some injection molded parts. The molds were taking a longer time to print or to produce. And so they said, hey, here's some 3D printing designs. Would you be able to print them? And our network collectively sent over 3,000 clips in less than 2 weeks.
Wow.
And we validated the network by saying, you can actually deploy a network. You can actually commandeer the network and have this mechanism of kind of building parts. And we learned a lot in the process.
So, and this is an interesting kind of thing. So because of the way that 3D printing is sort of infinitely configurable, you can actually, if you have this reserve army, so to speak, of 3D printers out there, whatever the need is that arises, the folks who own these and operate these, they can just turn quickly and produce whatever it is that's being called on. They don't have to retool. They don't have to buy new machines or anything. They can just feed in new computer instructions and you get the parts.
That's correct. And what we learned is that what you saw in this validation was what I would call the very beginnings of what is required to scale up and to do 3D printing, distributed 3D printing at scale. If you talk to any engineer today, they'll tell you that distributed 3D printing, there's a long ways off. There are many constraints. There are many, obstructions, obstacles in the way. And we've learned through that. So what we've identified are essentially three major areas. One is when we produce these clips, no one really owned the IP. These designs were open source designs. So you put them on the network, it didn't have a commercial implication or an economic implication. So we got to fix that part. We got to have a mechanism that basically says, if I produce 3D printed components, then there has to be the notion that the IP owner is protected, that their design is never compromised. Now, of course, you can take any component, it doesn't have to be 3D printed, and you can attempt to reverse engineer it. That's never going to change.
Right.
But what you don't want to have happen is someone gets a 3D print file, what we're calling the recipe, and that recipe becomes freely available because now you've reduced the friction and the barrier to someone just knocking off your component. So IP protection is number one. Number two, we did notice that because of the way the files were distributed, some components that were coming back to us were not coming back to us with the level of quality that was expected, because some of the physical manual configurations that were put in by the people that printed them were incorrect. So we need to make great advances in what I call repeatable product recipes. And what I mean by product recipes is this recipe has to be a complete and high fidelity digital twin of the original component. So much so that when you take a 3D printed component and you certify it for a particular application, You also need to have a framework that certifies its recipe for that same application. And if we can get to that point, which by the way, it's not a trivial task. It's not easy to do that, but it is a software task. In other words, it's a digital challenge. It's a digital technology challenge to get to that point where the recipe becomes the digital twin of that particular product. And then what we need to have is the third component is that recipe also needs to have built into it the intelligence for traceability and certification. In other words, the recipe is certified, but the recipe also tells you how it can be traceable. If we solve those problems, which by the way, like I said, not easy problems to solve, but also not insurmountable given some of the innovations that we have. Now what you do is we set the framework, the groundwork for distributed manufacturing at scale. Because if the recipe's intelligence, it will know based on the printer's configuration, whether that component that the printer prints out is compliant with the recipe. When we get to that point, now you have much more trust in the output. And that's where we are essentially when we're now starting on phase two of Project Diamond, and from becoming a network for what I would call this reactive preparedness, we want to create more of a commercial system where all our manufacturers can participate in this network for engaging in commerce and production. That's the goal of phase two of Project Diamond.
Okay. In the April issue of Mechanical Engineering Magazine, which I'm the editor of, our cover story was on the barriers of adoption to advanced manufacturing technologies at this scale, at this small and medium-sized enterprise scale. And several of the company leaders that we talked to mentioned things like concerns over return on investment or simply not knowing how to integrate these things into their processes. Some of the things that you've actually mentioned already, you know, what are you seeing in terms of these sorts of barriers? I mean, are they, you talked about the bell curve. Let's talk about the folks on the tail end of that bell curve that are really not getting it. Are there any sort of strategies that you have for trying to reach them and trying to show them the value of what's going on and why this could be useful for their businesses? Because I mean, obviously the folks who've taken it and are running with it, they don't need any convincing, but the folks in the middle folks are like everybody else, but the folks that are the laggards, probably be me. How do you reach them? How do you show them that this is something that they could be, you know, they ought to be using?
You know, this is the challenge. Whenever you have a traditional way of doing something, that traditional method starts becoming the golden standard, if you will, right? The gold standard of doing something. Mm-hmm. And then you have a new way of doing something and there's great resistance to change. And that's what we're observing. So when you talk about ROI, ROI is applicable when there is a very clear expectation of what the outcome is going to be to what the input is going to be. That's ROI is designed to be kind of that, you know, rigorous method that says, you know, hey, if I'm investing this much, then I know what the output, you know, I can model it. I can use mm-hmm. some kind of a rubric, some kind of a method. Well, when you're dealing with something that's that's disruptive and it's in a different sphere where it's not proven, you have to move away from what I would call traditional ROI to option-like thinking. And traditional ROI would be, you know, making a CapEx, capital expenditure investment in a business where you do things like NPV analysis and you basically model out cash flows and things like that. Options analysis is much more like the VCs do it out in Silicon Valley. You know, they'll have a portfolio of 10 companies. They expect 8 companies to essentially do nothing or, you know, maybe, you know, die. They right. expect one company to kind of be the zombie, but they have one company that they want 100x return on. And it's this spreading, this option-like portfolio that they create. They don't know which one's going to be it, but that's the thinking. The promise of Industry 4.0 and the promise of all technologies is that it tends to become more and more democratically available. So for example, take a look at this thing that's causing all kinds of heartburn, optimism, however you want to call it, the full spectrum of emotional responses, ChatGPT. The power that's available in something like ChatGPT would not have been available to anybody without any resources just a few years ago.
Right.
Today, you can get it for free and for $20 a month if you want to pay for the Plus membership. 3D printing, Industry 4.0 is like that. It's very, the more we move forward, the more we progress, the more democratic it becomes. And so what we're trying to, our message to these companies is, it's not about ROI, it's about learning. It's about understanding what this could mean in terms of the disruption that it could cause to your business. So a lot of it is just education. A lot of it is just, if this is the business that you're in, understand what these technologies could do to that business, what it does to the ecosystem in which you play. If you're part of a supply chain, but if your customer is starting to employ 3D printing and reducing part counts, for example, I don't know if you're following the news with Relativity Space. They just launched their rocket up in space. Right.
Yes.
Their part count has gone down by a factor of 100. That's two decimal places, from 10,000 to 100 parts. That is going to have an impact in the supply chain. So for those who say, I don't have the ROI, we're saying, well, but think about what happens if you don't do something. And so it's this combination of, you know, inspiration along with concern, you know, hey, pay attention to both sides. So that's why we call ourselves the Knowledge Center. Our goal is to get the owners and the executive sponsors of these businesses to act. That's the first goal. Once they start acting, once they start making decisions, the rest actually falls into place because there are resources that will get them what they need.
Yeah, in the article that I just referenced, someone mentioned that instead of ROI, people should focus on COI, which I believe is the cost of inaction.
Which there you go. Be, yeah.
Yeah. Which is, yeah. Which is basically, hey, you know, if you stay where you are and everybody races ahead, you're going to be left with nothing.
100%. Because,
yeah. So that, so that's a great way to put it. I mean, it's certainly a great way to think about how the folks that are on the tail end of the bell curve, you know, how they need to reconceive what their businesses are and right. how to incorporate, and not just 3D printing, but all sorts of, you know, digital and advanced manufacturing technologies into their business.
Yes. And, yeah. and if you marry COI with options analysis or option-like thinking, mm-hmm. now you have both sides of it. The COI is the cost. The option-like investment is, what can I learn from this? And what learning is going to give me that 10x return? And what might that look like? You know, so it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of right. the inspiration and fear, I think, have to both work hand in hand
right.
to motivate people into action.
Yeah, the option is the return, and the cost is the investment. So,
yes.
But and I was thinking when you were talking about the option. You know, they always talk about the unicorn on Silicon Valley, but I guess for every unicorn, there's about eight donkeys and one plow horse. So yes,
that's good.
Lay it out, be super optimistic. What's the promise of this technology for, you know, a small shop in Beech Grove, Indiana, or in Lewiston, Maine? And for that matter, the entire manufacturing industry, you know, how do you see, you know, like 10 years out, the manufacturing industry is transformed by these technologies? What's it going to look like?
So I'm going to put my rosy colored glasses on, because okay. those are the only glasses I have other than sure. the readers I just showed you earlier. But the fundamental dynamic that's occurring as we're talking about this is manufacturing as a discipline is moving away from a process-based discipline to a design and IP-based discipline. What I mean by that is, if you look at manufacturing today, the process that is used to make something is so intensive and plays such a large factor in the final outcome of the product that if I were an engineer and I'm conceiving of something, I have to pay great attention to how that is being made in terms of part counts, in terms of final application, cost, et cetera. Because that's just the reality of it. Am I going to be machining it? Am I going to be conforming it to something? Am I going to be using some, what subtractive or formative technology am I going to be using to produce this? And depending upon the final outcome, depending upon the cost, it's going to change the way I design. That process has huge bearing on the design. And so we are not living in a pure world. Physical manifestation is difficult, right? Physical manifestation, taking an idea and making it a physical product, which is manufacturing at scale, is difficult. Additive manufacturing is one example of technology that is breaking down the hold that process has over manufacturing, and it is making it a software play. It is basically saying to the engineer, don't worry about process. You just worry about the geometry and the design. And our software over time will get to the point where we're basically going to be, everything's going to be software driven. So Mr. or Ms. Engineer, you go design the best part, best component that you can, the best product, and think just about the user experience. And everything else will be sort of automatic. Now, are we there here today? No, we're not. But that's where it's going. That's where the puck is going. So with my rosy colored glasses, I'm basically saying our small and medium-sized manufacturers have a huge opportunity to move from process purveyors to IP owners. They are going to basically become portfolio owners of IP, of very specialized IP that they have an understanding that they own the user experience in. I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago even, we had a story in the Wall Street Journal of a company in Iceland that makes fish processing equipment. And traditionally, they were making this equipment with third-party suppliers because they use a lot of metal parts, machined parts, and things like that. They have transformed much of their product into 3D printed components. And that gives them great latitude in making their design purer to what that end outcome, the human objective of that product is. And if you look at it, they own a bunch of 3D printers, but that's not where the value is. The value is in the design of the fish processing equipment that produces the outcome that they want. And so they're already transforming into a into an IP portfolio holding organization that really understands fish processing.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is that manufacturers and industrial companies, which have traditionally had a lot of their property tied up in, you know, physical assets and in their machine tools and on the factory floor, the value of that will be reduced in proportion to the value of the intellectual property. In many ways, they're going to be more like, you know, sort of balanced the way that a television network or Walt Disney is, where the IP is actually what's bringing the value, not the cameras or the studios.
100%. In fact, you're already seeing that there's great, and especially where I live in the state of Michigan, we have, this is the home of the auto industry. And if you've seen what Wall Street has been telegraphing, whether you love or hate Tesla, they've been valuing Tesla because they see Tesla as the EV part of it is, in my estimation, more of a catalyst. But they're really valuing Tesla is their ability to be a software-driven organization that can quickly and in a very agile manner bring to market products. And they look at the traditional auto industries as having these, you know, traditional manufacturing plants and these manufacturing assets that they are undervaluing or that they don't provide, that they don't place as much value on. So whether you agree with that valuation or not, because it's a very polarizing subject, you know, you'll find people on both sides. That's the evidence of that type of thinking. That's already being shown in the market. And so 100%, that's exactly what's going that we see where the world is going, is your physical components, your processing equipment, those are just means to an end. But it's the IP that you have and your connection with your end customer and the end customer's user experience is what's going to keep your value in your organization.
Well, and then finally, let's talk about that end user, someone like me, a consumer, not a maker, although I did make this desk. So what's the big picture I should be focusing on with all these changes in manufacturing technology? What's in it for me seems like so trite and stuff, but what am I going to be seeing? How's it going to be affecting the way that I interact with, you know, companies and the material world, you know?
And so when you say you're asking this question as an end consumer.
Yeah, I'm an end consumer. I don't make anything, you know, or at least nothing physical.
I think, again, rosy colored glasses, I think that we have a great potential, a great opportunity to head into a world where we can essentially have the best user experiences possible at a reasonable price. We have an opportunity, if we do this right, to have prosperous ecosystems of small and medium-sized businesses, manufacturers that are so plugged into their communities, which then as end consumers will provide a much richer, more intimate experience. Because if you're an end consumer and you have a rich ecosystem of a smaller business that can really serve you very well, that can be a much more intimate relationship. And so, you know, that could be one outcome that we have, is we could have potentially Main Street businesses that are much more plugged into their consumers, but then also potentially could have global audiences, because if it's IP that you're doing at scale, then it doesn't really matter where you are, but you can still have great customer intimacy because you really understand that. It's kind of like that, you know, when Amazon first came out, one of the values that Amazon was pitching was, you know, those hard to find books.
Right.
We make those available because we can make a profit at selling one in two copies that a traditional high volume publisher can't. And so as a consumer, you could have a much richer experience of an end user experience, because you have the ability to have that one company that really understands you for who you are, be able to produce, you know, this product, essentially creating kind of like this vibrant global micro communities of interests, if you will.
Right. So like building out a long tail of manufactured goods rather than for books or
exactly.
Videos or something.
And the best part is none of that is ever in inventory. Mm. So we have great cash efficiency because it's all just material, and that material can be repurposed for many applications. That's the key value. So it's much more sustainable. It's much more environmentally friendly. That, again, rosy colored glasses, right? But still, I think that that's very possible that we could be there.
Well, I have to say that sounds great. I've got a lot more questions, but I'm looking at my watch. We have to leave it here. Pavan Mazumdar, thank you again for joining us today. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, and I enjoyed the conversation myself.
If those out there in podcast land are hungering for more conversations about engineering, we've got them. Subscribe to ASME TechCast on whatever podcast platform you prefer. For all of us at ASME, I'm Jeffrey Winters, wishing you a great rest of your day. Thanks.